From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Lyndon LaRouche and the New American Fascism. Dennis King's new book argues that LaRouche represents more than the kooky fringe of American politics. Despite LaRouche's recent conviction, King says LaRouche represents the inroads fascism has made into our political system. Entezaki Shange is best known as the author of For Colored Girls Who Have Considered Suicide, When the Rainbow is Enough. Today we talk about her new work that's premiering at the American Music Theater Festival. It's about growing up in the black middle class. And we have reviews of Madonna's new album and the new film, Heathers. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. Political extremist Lyndon LaRouche ran for president three consecutive times, beginning in 1976. Many people dismissed him as a paranoid kook. His announced objective was to build a grand coalition to rid American politics of the enemy within, the leftists, liberals, environmentalists, and Zionists. In his world of conspiracy theories, Henry Kissinger was a Soviet spy, and Queen Elizabeth the head of an international drug ring. But Dennis King says it's dangerous to dismiss LaRouche as a kook. According to King, LaRouche ran the best organized and wealthiest neo-fascist operation of the 1980s, and he made extraordinary inroads into American politics, surpassing the achievements of any other extremist movement in recent American history. Dennis King has been following the LaRouche story for 20 years and has been writing about him for 10. King's work has been published in The New Republic, The Wall Street Journal, and the New York City weekly Our Town. King has written a new book called Lyndon LaRouche and the New American Fascism. In January, LaRouche was sentenced to 15 years in prison for scheming to defraud the IRS and deliberately defaulting on more than $30 million in loans from supporters. LaRouche is now behind bars, so I asked Dennis King why he thinks it's still important to look into the story of LaRouche.
Because Lyndon LaRouche has proved something of vital importance to the American people, and that is our extreme vulnerability to manipulation and infiltration and influence by a cleverly disguised right-wing extremist movement. Now, LaRouche never wore a swastika on his arm, and he never made a Sieg Heil salute, and I don't think he ever dressed up in jack boots or in a Ku Klux Klan robe. His politics were the same, but he did disguise them. And based on that, he was able to make, in the 1980s, almost unbelievable inroads into American public life. He and his followers raised over $200 million from the American public. They ran thousands of candidates for public office, more candidates than any extremist group in American history. These candidates received millions of votes, and in fact, they won major primaries in Illinois in 1986, which upset the Democratic Party very much. In fact, they have also achieved primary victories in scores of races for Congress and state legislature around the country. And while doing all of this, they managed in the early 1980s to gain entree to the highest levels of the Reagan administration, to top officials of the National Security Council, and to major CIA officials, to people in the Pentagon, and they also formed close ties to high levels of the International Brotherhood of Teamsters, the largest union in America, and the most powerful union in America. Most of this was never reported in the daily press, which tended to depict LaRouche as some kind of kook who merely believes that the Queen of England pushes drugs. And by portraying him as simply a kook, they diverted people's attention away from the hard facts of the matter, which was that LaRouche had gained incredible influence in our society and had reached out and formed alliances of convenience and also ideological alliances with a wide variety of people on both the right and, in some cases, on the left.
How did you first become aware of Lyndon LaRouche?
I became aware of him in 1968 during the Columbia University student strike, when LaRouche was giving a seminar in a Columbia fraternity house. And I went to it, and he seemed to be a kind of a middle-aged guru who was looking for young followers. He was tremendously erudite. But curiously, at that time, he had a bushy beard and was dressed kind of like almost like a hippie, in sharp contrast contrast to the way he dresses today with his three-piece business suits and Texas Stetson hat and designer glasses.
LaRouche is an extremist who started out on the far left and ended up on the far right, but there was always some kind of mixing of the two extremes in his rhetoric. Let's start off with where he started on the far left. He started off in what, a Trotskyite splinter group of SDS?
Well, actually, LaRouche joined the Socialist Workers' Party, which is the main Trotskyist party in the United States, in 1948, and he was a member of it until 1965. At that time, he split away and soon formed his own organization inside SDS, that is, inside the Students for Democratic Society. And that group came to be known as the National Caucus of Labor Committees. In the early 1970s, it was avowedly a communist organization committed to making a socialist revolution in the United States. But LaRouche was already speculating with fascist-style ideas. And in the middle 1970s, over a period of about 4 years, he gradually nudged his followers from the far left to all the way over to the farthest most right, where he began to advocate a kind of cryptic version of neo-Nazism, complete with calls for the rounding up of the Jews and total war against the Soviet Union, bacteriological and chemical warfare to wipe out the so-called inferior species, and all kinds of really bizarre things that, you know, you would have heard in Nazi Germany.
You describe the National Caucus of Labor Committees, this group that he founded,
yes,
as a political group that used the tactics of religious cults to attract people and to keep them.
That's true. LaRouche could never have gotten away with transforming his left-wing followers into rightists if he had not first put them through some very rigorous psychological conditioning sessions. He called this ego stripping. And they would get people in a room and concentrate on one person at a time, breaking them down by just picking their personality apart. Some people got disgusted with this and quit his organization. But those who were willing to stick it out, they were gradually remolded. Their entire thinking was remolded to the point they were willing to accept just about anything LaRouche told them. Now, you said that, you know, he ended up with a kind of mixed ideology, but I would say that's not strictly speaking true, that he began on the left and he moved to the far right. And today I would define LaRouche as being really a fascist in the classic sense of that word. I mean, he embodies all of the ideas that you found in Nazi Germany and in Mussolini's Italy. Sometimes he has rephrased the ideas a little bit, but basically it's the same ideas and the same game plan, the drive to the East. I mean, he goes over to West Germany and he will give speeches before German military officers and defense contractors. He talks to them about, you know, literally developing super weapons through which Germany can rise again and dominate the planet. So he's trying to present himself really as being the new Hitler.
Back when he was starting off on the left, and as you described, using the tactics of cult groups to draw and keep people, he was using violence to break up the meetings of the groups that he saw as the opposition groups. Would you explain a little bit what his tactics were there?
Well, at that time, he saw the Communist Party USA as being the main organization on the far left, and that if he wanted to gain hegemony on the left, then he would have to discredit the Communist Party and essentially drive it out of business. And he decided the best way to do that would be to launch a campaign of physical terror against them in hopes that they would just collapse. Now, of course, this did not happen because the Communist Party and other left-wing groups in turn developed defense squads, and also local police came in and started arresting LaRouche's followers. But he accomplished something very important through this, and that is that he got his followers to essentially draw a line between themselves and the rest of the left, where they define the rest of the left as being evil social fascist counter-revolutionaries. That's what they called them at the time, whereas the NCLC was the only pure organization, the only trustworthy organization. So once they had drawn this line between themselves and the rest of the left, it was relatively easy for LaRouche to say to them, hey, the entire left is no good, let's move over to the right.
My guest is Dennis King, and he's written a new book called Lyndon LaRouche and the New American Fascism. You explained a little bit about how LaRouche managed to move his followers from the left to the right because they followed him as they'd follow a cult group leader. Was it easy for him to get any credibility once he shifted to the far right?
It was
credibility among people on the far right.
It ended up being very simple for him. I mean, as early as 1976, LaRouche approached top officials of the Republican Party and suggested that they join with his organization in a challenge of Jimmy Carter's election, because as you will remember, Carter won by a very narrow majority in some states. And the LaRoucheans actually gained the ear of, the head of the Republican National Committee, and they gained the ear of Senator Vandenjagt, who was the head of the Republican caucus in Congress, and they gained the ear of people very close to Gerald Ford. And they had Republicans around the country donating money to this effort to challenge Jimmy Carter's election. And in fact, the major newspapers at the time pointed out how this odd alliance had come about between the Republicans and the LaRouche's organization. And after that, they continued to cultivate conservatives, and much of the money that LaRouche raised over the following 10 years, these incredible sums of money, came from conservatives, came from supporters of Ronald Reagan. Now, many of these people were misled by LaRouche because he exaggerated the degree to which he was in agreement with Ronald Reagan. In fact, I would say LaRouche was not really in agreement with Ronald Reagan on anything at all. He just pretended to be. But nevertheless, by disguising himself as a conservative, he was able to raise large amounts of money, and there were many, many naive conservatives out there who just simply would not listen to people in the conservative movement who repeatedly warned them. To give you examples, the National Review in 1979 did an excellent front-page article about LaRouche's ties to the Ku Klux Klan, and and they warned conservatives against him, but people didn't listen. Then General Danny Graham, the head of High Frontiers, which is a group that lobbies for Star Wars, he also spoke out repeatedly warning people in the defense community to beware of LaRouche, but many people didn't listen, and so LaRouche was able to gain a remarkable series of ties with important defense scientists and with people around the Pentagon. And he actually emerged as kind of a leading publicist for Star Wars during the early 1980s.
Well, he set up something called the Fusion Energy Foundation, which you describe as his front group for, you describe it as basically the science and technology division of the NCLC. Why was he so, why did he become such an advocate of beam weapons?
Well, I think the reason for this is LaRouche's stated that his long-range goal is to establish the rule of a what he calls the super race of golden souls over the earth. And the golden souls he envisions as being his own followers, and essentially kind of like the second generation of his followers who will raise his ideology to the nth degree of effectiveness and power. But he believes that there's an evil oligarchy that today dominates the earth. And these oligarchs, when he gets down to describing them in detail, almost always have Jewish names and have a special connection to the Rothschild family and the State of Israel and the Anti-Defamation League. So it's very clear he's talking about the Jews. But as LaRouche sees it, people with his fascist ideology have to come to power in the major countries of the West, unify the West, and then prepare it for total war. And he has a whole complicated economic theory of how you prepare for total war through throwing trillions of dollars into huge centralized defense research projects. And LaRouche's idea was that America would develop weapons so powerful that they, of course, would share with the Germans, that they would be able to just totally wipe out the Soviet Union and anybody else who might stand in the way of LaRouche's vision of this unified planet under one government.
LaRouche followers used to have tables of literature advocating beam weapons In airports is where they'd set up with the literature. Did you ever run into them at airports?
Oh, many, many times. I mean, I would imagine there's tens of millions of Americans have seen their signs at airports. And
what would the signs say?
Well, they would, back in the middle of 1970s, they would support nuclear power. Then they were promoting fusion energy with the belief the government should pour billions of dollars into a crash program to develop fusion energy. And incidentally, on that point, they may very well have been right. And that's one of the things that makes LaRouche so dangerous, is that on many individual issues, he comes up with ideas that make sense. But then they dropped fusion energy and went into promoting beam weapons around 1981. And 2 years later, of course, Ronald Reagan announced suddenly out of the blue and surprising the entire press corps that the U.S. was going to embark upon a program of developing precisely these beam weapons. Curiously, the LaRouchians knew months ahead of time that Reagan was going to make the speech, because they were in close contact with the scientists and policymakers involved in that decision.
I want to talk with you more about Lyndon LaRouche, but first we're going to take a short break. My guest is Dennis King, the author of the new book, Lyndon LaRouche and the New American Fascism. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
My guest is Dennis King, and for the past 20 years, he's been following Lyndon LaRouche's attempts to build a political base in this country. King has put together his findings in the new book, Lyndon LaRouche and the New American Fascism. I think one of the things that frightens you most about LaRouche is the inroads that he made into the electoral system in the United States. It was in the mid-70s that he started running election campaigns. He started off as a Republican, then switched to the Democratic Party. Would you explain the logic behind his change?
Well, actually, he didn't start off as a Republican. He started off with his own independent electoral party called mm-hmm. the U.S. Labor Party. Then in 1979, he was running for president, and he realized that if he wanted to gain a large vote and start really collecting a lot of money for his campaign from conservatives down in Texas, he would need to enter one of the major parties, because only in the major party primaries can a maverick really have any chance of gaining a major vote. Now, LaRouche could have gone into the Republican Party, but there was already an organized right wing within the Republican Party, and if he had gone in there, he would have been seen as an interloper and would have been literally driven out. But very cleverly, LaRouche chose the Democratic Party, because that is the party where there was no organized right wing. In other words, it was a vacuum. He could move in and immediately set himself up as a counterpole to the liberal party leadership. And also, the Democratic Party does have in its grassroots base, you know, a large number of conservative-minded people. And they tend to be those conservatives of lower income, farmers, blue-collar workers. They stay in the Democratic Party because they agree with its social programs, even though on all other issues they are would be probably feel more comfortable in the Republican Party. But LaRouche decided that he would try and become the new George Wallace, to appeal to these people. He would appeal to the what he called the forgotten majority of the Democratic Party. So he moved into the party in the early in 1979, and in after the primaries in 1980, in which he gained almost 200,000 votes, he set up an organization for permanent long-range infiltration of the Democratic Party. Now, earlier on the show, I was sort of critical of the Republicans, but I want to balance that, because I think that the Democrats have behaved with equal foolishness in their dealings with Lyndon LaRouche down the years, because at any time they could have drawn a line and thrown LaRouche out of the Democratic Party. Instead, they chose to ignore him. And in 1982, LaRouche had a candidate who ran for governor of Pennsylvania, came in second out of four candidates with 19% of the vote. I mean, that was a clear warning sign that LaRouche was up to something, that he was mining voter discontent. In 1983, his people ran over 500 candidates. And in 1984, they ran over 2,000 candidates and actually won their first congressional primary. Now, the warning signs were there, but the Democratic Party simply would not do anything about it. They tried to rationalize it away. No matter how many candidates LaRouche ran, their answer was, oh, LaRouche is just a kook. We have nothing to worry about.
You say that Lyndon LaRouche learned to exploit the weaknesses of the two-party system.
That's true.
In the United States. What do you mean by that?
The basic weakness he exploits is that both parties will allow anybody to walk in and declare himself a Democrat or Republican and, sign up, register as a party member without having to adhere to any kind of philosophical principles whatsoever. And thus David Duke, who is a Nazi, can call himself a Republican, and LaRouche, who is a Nazi, can call himself a Democrat. And here in Manhattan, the Communist Workers' Party, who are followers of Pol Pot, can call themselves Democrats. And there's no mechanism at the present time for keeping extremists out of the major party primaries. Now, listen, I support the civil liberties of these people, even though I don't like them. I believe that Lyndon LaRouche and David Duke and the Communist Workers' Party have the constitutional right to run for public office, and they have the right to publish literature. They have the right to function, as citizens of a free society. But the Democratic and Republican parties are private organizations. These are not government organizations, and they have a right and a duty to draw a line someplace and to say, hey, you're not one of us. You cannot run in our primary. If you want to run, go form your own party and have your own party primary. I think that's a perfectly reasonable request, and I think it's high time that both the Democrats and the Republicans made up their minds to enforce, some kind of reasonable standard of membership.
I've noticed that when you speak of LaRouche or his organization, you use the present tense, in spite of the fact that LaRouche is behind bars now.
Well, Adolf Hitler went to prison for the Munich Beer Hall Putsch, and it didn't put his Nazi party out of business. Reverend Moon went to jail, like LaRouche, for income tax evasion, and it didn't put the Unification Church out of business. In fact, the Unification Church is stronger than ever. Virtually the entire leadership of Scientology went to jail a few years ago for dirty tricks against the government, stealing government files and so on, and yet Scientology is more popular than ever today. So just taking examples there, both from the history of political extremism and from the history of cultism, I don't see that you can say that the jailing of a leader is going to automatically lead to the demise of one of these movements. LaRouche has created an ideology. He's created a body of strategy and tactics, which are very impressive. And this stuff has a life of its own. He's created an organization which is composed of members who, many of whom, are very, very committed. And just because he's in jail, these people are not suddenly going to walk away from the ideology that they have accepted for the past 20 years of their lives. So I think it's quite possible that his organization will continue to be an important player on the far right in this country. And already you can see by the victory of David Duke for the state legislature in Louisiana that LaRouche's strategy and tactics has spread beyond the ranks of his own organization into the larger world of American white supremacy.
And how do you see David Duke as being an extension of LaRouchean
because
politics?
Duke and the other traditional white supremacists, after LaRouche's 1986 victories, began to have meetings to discuss adopting LaRouche's strategy. And in fact, the premier ideologue of white supremacy, Bob Miles, wrote an article in his newsletter in which he praised LaRouche for, his political raiders had struck a blow against Zionism, and he said, "Well done, Lyndon, well done." And groups that monitor the far right, like the Center for Democratic Renewal in Atlanta, have been publishing articles for 3 years now warning that the traditional white supremacists were going to adopt LaRouche's tactic, that is one of infiltrating the major parties, and doing it in a sort of on three levels at once. In other words, infiltrate the Democrats, but also infiltrate the Republicans, which LaRouche has done to a certain extent, and also run independent candidates when that seems to be the best tactic. So, and LaRouche has also done that, because when he lost the Democratic primaries in 84 and 88, he then ran as an independent on both occasions. So the David Duke forces adopted that policy, and Duke ran in the Democratic primaries for president in 88, and when he did not do very well there, he simply switched to the Republican Party and ran for the state legislature in Louisiana. And he disguised his Nazism and started to call himself an environmentalist and simply a promoter of traditional conservative values. And he carefully did not put on any bedsheets during the campaign. And the result of that was that he won, even though both Ronald Reagan and George Bush called on the voters of that district to vote against David Duke. Nevertheless, he won. And that showed the power of the strategy and tactics that that LaRouche has devised. In other words, it's a strategy of not coming out in the open and slapping the public in the face with your extremist politics, but instead disguising that politics like a subtle virus disguises itself. And sort of you get into the middle of the political process, and then you gradually begin to poison it and to spread more and more extremist ideas and find more and more people who are opportunist enough to make a pact with the devil, so to speak. And that's the way an extremist movement always grows. A very great woman named Hannah Arendt wrote the book Origins of Totalitarianism, in which she described this process after having studied the history of Bolshevism and Nazism and Mussolini's fascism, all three. And I think that everything Lyndon LaRouche does, and every bizarre way in which the political structure in this country has reacted to him, all of that can be found in Hannah Arendt's book. In other words, there's nothing really new under the sun here. It's LaRouche is mining an old tradition.
You've been following LaRouche for about 20 years and writing about him for around 10. Have you ever been harassed by LaRouche's followers?
Absolutely. When I first published articles about them in the newspaper Our Town in 1979, the LaRoucheans immediately began putting out smear leaflets against myself and the publisher of Our Town. They broke into the offices of Our Town. They sent imposters around to gather information. They went to the advertisers of Our Town and threatened them that they would be sued if they didn't drop their advertising. And then they sued me, and I was in court with them for over a year, and eventually they dropped the suit, but then they sued me again in 1984 when I cooperated with NBC in a television show on LaRouche. And in between, I was subjected to death threats. Members of my family were harassed. Personal friends of mine were harassed. Smear leaflets about me were put under the doors in the building where I lived. And it was sort of like guerrilla warfare. You know, you would never know when they were going to strike again. But a journalist who chooses to write about nasty people has to expect that kind of thing.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Dennis King's new book, Lyndon LaRouche and the New American Fascism, is published by Doubleday. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, a behind-the-scenes look at television script writing, and we find out the answer to such questions as what are the best plot points to insert commercials and how many laughs should there be per sitcom episode. My guest, Carl Sauter, was the story editor for Moonlighting during its first two seasons and is the author of the new book, How to Sell Your Screenplay. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Entezaki Shange is the author of For Colored Girls Who Have Considered Suicide, When the Rainbow is Enough. Coming up, we talk about her new music theater piece, Betsy Brown. It's the story of a 13-year-old girl whose middle-class parents have raised her to be a soldier for the advancement of the race. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Madonna's new album, Like a Prayer. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews the new teen movie, Heathers. Stephen says while most teen movies are just insipid, Heathers has a dark undercurrent that makes it stand out from the rest. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
I'm Sharon Green. The captain of the tanker that spilled millions of gallons of oil in pristine Alaskan waters was legally drunk at the time of the accident. Investigators say Captain Joseph Hazelwood had a blood alcohol level of 0.061 when he was tested 9 hours after his ship ran aground. The Coast Guard limit for operating a vessel at sea is 0.04. The captain was not on the bridge at the time of the accident. An uncertified third mate was guiding the vessel. In Washington, President Bush has decided to hold off federalizing the Alaska cleanup effort. Officials who assessed the situation for the president said the cleanup is progressing well. In Alaska, legislators have promised quick action on Governor Steve Cooper's emergency request for $20 million in cleanup funds. A 5-day prison takeover in Guatemala ended peacefully today, and more than 560 hostages are heading home. Susan Leffler reports.
Riot leaders and government officials signed an agreement in the prison courtyard, ending several days of tense negotiations. According to the document, the prison's warden and guards will be replaced, living conditions will be improved, and the country's interior minister will ask authorities to consider prisoners' requests for pardons and reduced sentences. Roughly 60 people were killed or injured during the siege, but today was a happy one for survivors and their loved ones. For National Public Radio, I'm Susan Leffler in Guatemala City.
Oliver North's criminal trial is in recess until Monday. The prosecution rested today. Trial Judge Gerhard Gesell is considering a defense request to order former President Ronald Reagan to testify in North's behalf. The defense has argued that Reagan's testimony is essential to North's case, that the fired White House aide was just following orders from his commander-in-chief. Gesell will rule on whether to require Reagan to testify or whether to permit parts of Reagan's diary or his answers to questions from a grand jury to be admitted as evidence in North's trial. Soviet President Mikhail Gorbachev will make a visit to Cuba beginning on Sunday, and the Bush administration says it is looking for signs of new thinking, specifically reduction in the $1 billion a year in aid to the Marxist government in Nicaragua. More from Barry Schwein.
Speaking in Atlanta, Secretary of State James Baker said the U.S. and its friends in the hemisphere need to see Soviet new thinking demonstrated. He said they won't stand for outsiders using the hemisphere as a dumping ground for weapons and what Baker called failed ideology. In Washington, the White House spokesman, Marlon Fitzwater, said President Bush had asked Gorbachev to use his influence to support a peaceful settlement in Nicaragua between the Sandinistas and the Contras. The State Department spokeswoman, Margaret Tutwiler, was given a tougher line to enunciate. She accused the Soviets of supporting violence and subversion. For National Public Radio, this is Barry Schwein at the State Department.
At least 3 Palestinians have been killed, 33 wounded in Land Day clashes with Israeli troops. Land Day marks the 1976 killings of 6 Arabs by Israeli forces during protests of Israeli seizures of Arab land. Today's violence in the occupied territories came in spite of massive Israeli troop deployments and the sealing off of the area. Inside Israel, 700,000 Arab citizens commemorated Land Day with a general strike and protest rallies. In South Korea today, 700 striking dock workers were arrested and 20 people injured in a clash with riot police at the country's biggest shipyard. A strike over pay and working conditions at the Hyundai Heavy Industries Company has paralyzed output there for over 3 months. Police in full riot gear used a bulldozer to ram striker barricades. Stock prices closed mixed today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 0.18 to close at 2281.34, but advances marginally edged declines on volume of 161 million shares. You're listening to National Public Radio in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. In a recent New York Times interview with Stephen Holden, Madonna said, "What I do is commercialism, but it's also art." She also said, "Art should be controversial, and that's all there is to it." One of Madonna's latest controversial commercial artistic ventures is some Pepsi-Cola TV ads that feature her and her new song, Like a Prayer. She's getting a reported $5 million for the deal. A Like a Prayer album that includes a fact sheet about AIDS has been released, along with a video. Rock critic Ken Tucker has some thoughts on Madonna's latest projects.
Michael Jackson long ago rejected the idea that his music could actually communicate anything other than a good beat. Prince lately seems content to be an irrelevant eccentric, and Bruce Springsteen is being sued by some of his former roadies for being a bad boss. In this sort of pop atmosphere, it's nice to have a superstar who wants to amass her latest fortune by stirring things up rather than merely meeting her audience's most knee-jerk expectations. Madonna's Like a Prayer album is uneven as music, but as a pop phenomenon, it's immensely satisfying. To date, it's the rock world's wettest kiss-off to the Reagan era. The Like a Prayer TV commercial plot suggests Madonna's alienation from her Catholic upbringing. But the entirely different music video that Madonna has created with director Mary Lambert for the same song doesn't suggest anything. This Like a Prayer video is the most brazen co-optation of organized religion since Bob Dylan started using fundamentalism for his own purposes. Talk about upping the stakes. These days, if you want to be a Madonna wannabe, you have to open your palms to reveal gushing stigmata, equate the church with jail, and shake your groove thing in front of a field of burning crosses. It helps, of course, that the music accompanying these desecrations is absolutely irresistible. In her dense, intricate use of religious symbolism, Madonna has probably done more to instruct non-Catholics into the faith than any layperson since G.K. Chesterton.
Seems like yesterday I lay down.
It's too bad that the rest of the Like a Prayer album isn't as exciting as its title song, but that would probably have been impossible. For much of the rest of the album, Madonna is content to make pretty ballads like the one I just played, one of seven created with songwriter and co-producer Patrick Leonard. Their collaborations stink nearly as badly as the patchouli oil that Madonna has ordered all copies of Like a Prayer to be doused in. It's yet another way to give people headaches. One of these collaborations with Patrick Leonard unfortunately threatens to overshadow the Like a Prayer video for media attention. Till Death Do Us Part moans and groans at great length about a bad marriage, and it is assumed that Madonna is talking about her own tough times with Sean Penn. The only other truly good pop songs are a funny little collaboration with Prince called Love Song, and one written with Stephen Bray called Express Yourself. On Express Yourself, Madonna locates the feminism that was always there in 60s soul music by acts like the Marvelettes and Martha and the Vandellas. Using her gift for artful overstatement, Madonna makes the message as prominent as the beat without ruining the music.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for the Philadelphia Inquirer. This is Fresh Air. Entezaki Shange is best known for her 1976 landmark play for colored girls who have considered suicide, When the Rainbow is Enough. That play was a series of poetic monologues which dramatized the deepest feelings of young black women. Shange's new music theater piece is based on her novel Betsy Brown. It's about a 13-year-old middle-class girl growing up in St. Louis in 1959. Her parents put constant pressure on the children to excel and be soldiers for the advancement of the race. Each morning, the parents quiz the children about leading contemporary and historical black figures. Who is the president of Ghana? Who are Prez, Lady Day, and Bird? Shange told me this part of the story is autobiographical. Her parents are both professionals, determined to keep the struggles of black people in the forefront of their lives.
It was unforgivable. It was tantamount to a sin of omission, to not know. Some achievement of anyone in the race. That is, in fact, one of the really terrible things that's occurred in the so-called American education system since the Civil Rights Movement, which is that the black history that was taught in the so-called Negro schools, which was very, very detailed and very, very nationalistic and full of racial chauvinism, and also full of great lyric beauty and a sense of the drama and the victory of our survival and triumph over slavery, was totally written out of everyone's life. That no longer takes place in American history. So no one knows the words. Little children no longer know what the Negro National Anthem is, much less the words. They don't know who Kid Chocolate was. They don't know why Cassius Clay, who became Muhammad Ali, was important. They don't know why he could possibly have gone to jail. They don't know who Emmett Till was. They don't know who Governor Faubus was. I think it's very dangerous to be a black person in the United States and not know who Governor Faubus was, or Senator Eastland, or Huey Long.
In Betsy Brown, the children are exposed to two mother-type figures, their own mother, mm-hmm. a middle-class woman who's really stressing education in their lives. And then when the mother leaves home for a while, they're exposed to a maid who is hired.
Well,
a domestic?
You ever call it household help.
Household help. Okay, thank you. who's hired and who is just from a really different part of black culture, and it's something that's fairly new to the children. And they're kind of caught between both worlds in a way. They want both worlds in their life. But the mother doesn't want both worlds. Explain the distrust the mother has.
For Carrie,
the woman
Jane
who's hired to work
fought,
in the house. Jane is the mother.
Yes. Jane has fought all her life to make sure that her children never have to know a certain kind of desperation. Never have to know a certain kind of indignity. That when white people talk to them, you could talk back to them in the language they would understand. And if you couldn't put them in their place, you could at least let them know that you were not step and fetch it. When Jane sees Carrie, she sees not only what she might have stayed in, but she also sees what might take her children back, because that was the overwhelming mass of the black population at that point was still rural, was still black. It was still black English speaking. It was not speaking the King's English. Jane's also terrified of what she calls swamp music and slave religion, both of which require abandon. There is no space for abandon in Jane's fanatic mission to improve the race. There is no time for it.
You grew up in a middle-class family yourself, and there were women who were hired in the house to work. Did you feel like the children in Betsy Brown exposed to different cultures in your house?
Oh, I thought that's one of the reasons why I know that there's no such thing as monolithic black culture, because women who came from Tennessee were different from the ones from Arkansas. The ones from southern Missouri were different from the ones from Louisiana. The ones who came down from Chicago were different from the ones in St. Louis. The ones who came from rural Kansas were different from the ones from Cairo, Illinois.
What kind of school did you go to when you were growing up?
Oh, that was. I went to a wonderful black school called Clark School, which is right across the street from my house. It was a totally black school. And when I tested for the Gifted Children's Program, there was one in a black school called Ashland School that I desperately wanted to go to because all my other friends were going to go there. My parents decided that I could go to the white one. And it left, I'm getting chills on my spine now. It was absolutely traumatic. It was one of the most devastating, lonely periods of my life. If it hadn't been for the fact that I lived in a black neighborhood, I'm sure I could not possibly have emotionally survived that. I looked so forward to 3:30 when I could go home. And by home, I meant where I did not look like something that didn't belong somewhere.
Why did your parents want you to go to the white school instead of the black school?
Because I had a right to. Because I lived in the district where I could do that. They were giving the Negro parents the option of not, you don't have to send your children to the white school if you don't want to. Well, that made my mother furious. She said, we live in this district, that's where she's going.
In 1976... in an interview in The Village Voice, and this was after For Colored Girls was staged, you said, as a black feminist, I usually feel cheated by black theater. Does that still describe your experience? Cheated in what way?
First of all, we are represented in a minuscule number compared to the number of men who are produced, first of all. Secondly, the versions of women in theater that men, or white or black, write, are so one-dimensional, be it sexual or intellectual, that it's insulting. Thirdly, our perception of our own lives and our use of language has been denied me because I can't hear it. I'm not interested actually terribly much, even if they, suppose August Wilson did write five fabulous, incredible, wonderful women characters. That'd be a wonderful and interesting achievement for August Wilson. That's not going to help the development of black feminist theater.
You know, it's interesting. I know when For Colored Girls came out, some men thought that, oh, this is a really anti-male play. And several of the black men who I've interviewed recently have said the same thing to me, which is that they think right now only Among black writers, only black women are considered marketable, that they're the ones who are getting all the attention from the publishers and the press.
There's
and I'm sure you've been
that.
Hearing this.
I've heard all this, and I really think that this... I think the reason is I've always been very consistent about this, and I'm not changing my point of view at all for the last 20 years. Since Richard Wright and Ralph Ellison, and James Baldwin, for that matter, even Malcolm X, to a certain extent, whom I revere, black men have essentially been what I call other-oriented. So their works are not what I would call so much protest works, but they are making what I call sort of conscious and obvious efforts to proclaim themselves to the white world. In Soldier's Play, there are all these speeches telling us about the terrible things that happened to the black people in the army. In The Mighty Gents, they are saying how bad they are compared to the white people. That's really not interesting. Nobody really cares about that. What we care about is their lives, who they love, who they hate, what they do with their time, what do they think, what do they dream. I think they have some very serious literary introspection to do, and I don't think it has anything to do with publishers at all.
So do you feel that in your plays and poems and novels, what you're trying to do is what you just mentioned, talk about how people live their lives, who they love, what they think
As
about?
As Roy Jones said, culture is how people live. I'm supposed to be exploring and documenting my culture before it disappears. We don't have the pyramids. We don't have mummification. We don't have Pompeii to come and put lava all over Philadelphia on North Broad Street to freeze the black people so I can bring Savannah back here and show her how black people live.
Savannah's your daughter.
Yes. Therefore, this is the best I can do to document that we were here, we had feelings, we had passion, we had conflicts, we had intellectual duels, we had an incredible emotional and physical impoverishment that we survived, and I have an obligation to document that.
Entezaki Shange's new play, Betsy Brown, premieres this week in Philadelphia. It's produced by the American Music Theater Festival.
I am not gonna tell you all again. It's the educated Negro that saves the race. Not that nasty music your father's always playing around this place.
This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is joining us from Washington, D.C. to tell us what's coming up on All Things Considered. Noah, are you still following up on the oil spill?
Oh, sure, Terry. NPR's Daniel Zwerling is in Valdez, reports tonight on the cleanup and investigation of the oil spill from the tanker Exxon Valdez. Also, Alaska's governor, Steve Cooper, tells us that the cleanup plan is going okay in his view. He's complaining there was a serious delay in responding to the spill. He blames the pipeline consortium more than he does Exxon. Also tonight, Daniel Pinkwater, his series continues about growing up to be an artist. Tonight's episode is called Unfinished Oak. And a farewell to veteran radio broadcaster from Chicago, Earl Nightingale. It's been said of Earl Nightingale that he invented the motivational industry.
Thanks, Noah. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Heathers is a new film about contemporary high school life. Film critic Stephen Schiff has this review.
So you thought the era of the teen comedy was safely past. I had hoped so, too. But the biggest surprise hits of the last several weeks have been Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure, a kids' movie whose message seems to be that it's totally cool to be stupid, and Lean on Me, an attempt to turn a neo-fascist school principal into a father figure for young audiences who, quite reasonably, find high school terrifying. And now comes Heathers, a high school movie, and moreover, a high school movie that's nothing less than brilliant. It's inventive and funny and scary enough to revive the genre single-handed. One of the most powerful memories I have of high school is how dramatic everything felt, how consumed one could become by the inequities and complexities of high school society. I remember thinking that, however old I got, I would never forget that drama in all its intensity. But of course I have over the years. The makers of Heathers have not. The sensibility behind this movie is young, very close to the outrage that high school inevitably stirs in sensitive young hearts. But the movie isn't maudlin. Instead, it's darkly satirical. Heathers begins as a send-up of high school cliques and the cult of popularity. The three coolest girls in the school, all brittle young beauties named Heather, are cultivating a new friend, Veronica, played with the most winsome delicacy by Winona Ryder. Veronica wants to be a celebrated social queen like the Heathers, but she can't help being revolted by their cruelty. And it's not until she meets a leather-jacketed outsider called Jason Dean, J.D. for short, that she feels able to articulate her angst.
Is your life perfect?
Oh, yeah, I'm on my way to a party at Remington University. No, my life's not perfect. I don't really like my friends.
Yeah, I don't really like your friends either.
Well, it's just like there are people I work with and our job is being popular.
Maybe it's time to take a vacation.
JD is played by Christian Slater, who has gone from being the snivel-nosed wonk you might remember from The Name of the Rose to a snarly young stud doing a flagrant Jack Nicholson imitation. His J.D. disapproves of the Heathers, at least as much as Veronica does, but with a difference. At heart, Veronica's a nice kid. J.D., however, is something of a psychopath, willing to commit the most ghastly deeds in order to correct the school's social imbalances. Quickly, Heathers goes from being a sharp parody of the quest for popularity to something very strange. It turns its gleeful, satirical eye on teenage suicide, of all things, and its vision grows bleaker and more claustrophobic by the second. The writer, a first-timer named Daniel Waters, has concocted a slick and convincing high school slang, and the director, another first-timer named Michael Lemon, has style to burn. Even when Heathers is ragged, and it often is, especially at the climax, it's always compulsively watchable. This is an icy film, smirky and brainy and sometimes rather forbidding. You can feel monstrous egos pulsating behind the celluloid, and many audiences may feel that the filmmakers go too far. This isn't fun anymore, they may want to scream. But for me, some of the best fun to be had at the movies comes when all your expectations are overthrown. And in that way, Heathers succeeds brilliantly.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for Vanity Fair and is a contributing correspondent to West 57th. Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. Next time, composer Steve Reich talks about his new work, Different Trains. It's inspired by Reich's childhood memories of traveling across the country by train during the late 30s and early 40s, and his later realization that at the same time in Europe, Jews were traveling on trains to their deaths. Also, pianist Dave McKenna plays a spring medley in our weekly performance spot, and critic at large Laurie Stone reviews The War Zone, Alexander Stewart's novel about a boy growing up in a family victimized by incest. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who makes Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Naomi Person, Phyllis Myers, and Amy Salad. Production assistants from Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton. Research assistants from Christopher Cook and Peter Murdoch. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. Our engineer is Joyce Lieberman. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.